From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, a conversation with the 2023 Bess Lomax Hawes National Heritage Fellow, Nick Spitzer. Folklife presenter, educator, and radio producer and host, Nick's journey is as diverse as the cultural tapestry he's spent his life exploring. Trained as a folklorist with an anthropological lens and marked by the rhythms of radio, Nick's work blends sound, stories, and cultural insights to create unique narratives that resonate with a wide and diverse audience. With his early experiences in radio and his groundbreaking fieldwork in Louisiana, Nick's deep-rooted passion for music and culture has guided his career in exploring and presenting vernacular or folk culture. For example, he launched the Louisiana Folklife Program. He's curated programs for the Smithsonian's American Folklife Festival. He spent 7 seasons as artistic director of Folkmasters at Carnegie Hall and Wolf Trap, and he created American Roots Independence Day concerts on the National Mall. Nick would go on to create, produce, and host the acclaimed radio show American Roots, which for 25 years has been playing Cajun, Creole, jazz, blues, gospel, country, Tejano, Latin, and Caribbean music, as well as roots rock and soul, accompanied by insightful interviews with the artists. And from 1997 through 2014, Nick Spitzer was also the host of the National Heritage Fellowship Concert, which is how I met him. So in many ways, interviewing Nick was like having a conversation with an old friend, but one who still has the ability to surprise. Nick Spitzer, 2023 National Heritage Fellow. You know, I've known you for years, and in preparing for this interview, I was shocked at how much I didn't know about what you do. So how do you describe your own work?
Well, I'm trained as a folklorist from an anthropological point of view, but I've also grew up through radio ever since college days and have continued to do radio. I sort of see sound recordings of people's personal narratives and conversations about culture as part of the way we exchange understanding of cultural difference and similarities, and a way to take deep understandings of culture and with the addition of music and various environmental sounds and conversation, reach a really wide and diverse audience. So you could say I'm a public scholar, an engaged scholar, a public folklorist. I guess I'm a lot of different things, but you know, most of the time I just see myself as somebody having a cultural conversation with somebody about the past and cultural continuity into the present, and what the possibility is for the future of culture's traditions in a creative sense and in a sense of maintaining continuities from the past to the future.
Nick, where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in New York City in 1950, right at the middle of the so-called American century. Lived there till I was about 3 and a half. And then we moved out onto Long Island for a few years. But I really grew up formatively in a small town in Connecticut called Old Lyme on the Connecticut River. And my mother, who was the single daughter of a suffragette, always had a very strong sense of public culture and learning who people were around you and respecting them. And so she made it clear to me all the time that, you know, enjoy and watch, but don't say things unless you know what you're doing. I credit my mother introducing me to people and never being afraid to ask questions and just in goodwill try to build conversations. So that had a lot of impact on me as life went on. And I grew up in this small town, Old Lyme, and you know, I just got a very strong sense of the totality of the town and learning to respect all the different people in the town. And I just feel extremely lucky that I had that experience.
So where was radio in your life when you were a kid? Were you listening to the radio a lot, or did that come later?
I grew up just as we were beginning to get FM stereo on the radio. And my brother's 4 years older than I. And when we shared a bedroom, you know, I'd be hearing Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Fats Domino. You know, I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. And I'm thinking, what thrill? What hill? What is it? Dion's there, you know, singing away with doo-wop. And Anyway, so listening to my brother's music, I kind of like that. But when we got FM stereo, all of a sudden, here's Bob Dylan, here's the Beatles, here's all the new music that's coming out. You know, it's 1965, and everything is going forward in a new way. And so for me, radio was magic. So by the time I left to go off to college in Philadelphia, I was already very attuned to what I loved on the radio, whether it was a hockey game from Montreal in French, a baseball game from out west, or all these wild and crazy DJs, and just especially the music. And, I just felt they were playing these songs just for me. And so I felt very good about radio for a long time, and I never stopped loving it. And then I started actually producing it when I was in college at WXPN, the college radio station.
And before we go there, because I definitely do want to go there, you went away to college. You went to the University of Pennsylvania. Did you even know there was a thing called folkloric studies when you went there?
No, I didn't. At Penn, I was listening to my mother and father. My brother had been an environmental kind of wunderkind at the age of 14. He was being interviewed by the congressional panels on why ospreys were dying in the Connecticut River Valley. And I was much more into art and culture side of life. And so I started to, I guess, find my way. They wanted me in the Wharton School because they said, well, he's going to be in ecology and we need someone in this family who will have a real business. You know, ecology wasn't seen as a science at that point. My dad was a scientist. And so my mother was very tolerant of my, what she would call my creative side. I said, now, Nick, you know, Wallace Stevens and also Charles Ives, and I know you like Charles Ives and Wallace Stevens poetry you've been reading in school. Both of these men became insurance workers. They were businessmen. And then once they made a decent living, then they did their work, poetry and music. She said, you should be like that. You should go to the Wharton School at Penn. And my father said, you better go to the Wharton School. But within one semester, I realized I didn't want to be an insurance person. I didn't want to be a business person. I didn't want to be a lawyer or a doctor. I wanted to just have the freedom to enjoy the music that was now coming to me through the college radio station, and also going out and hearing Coltrane's old band in Philly and hearing Doc Watson play on campus and Mississippi John Hurt. And I was just being open to this whole wide range of music. And it did turn out that Penn had a very well-respected folklore and folklife department. And so I started taking courses there and in anthropology. And one of my key mentors was John Zwed, who actually ended up being the person that nominated me for the Heritage Awards. He's still alive.
So, Nick, when or how did you connect your studies in folklife culture to the music you were playing at the radio station?
I just opened up to the idea that avant-garde jazz could be understood as vernacular, kind of like folkloric music. And at the radio station, there's 20,000 records, this is LB days. That wall of records was the sounds of people, their rituals, their festivals, their music, their narratives. And I stumbled onto two records in particular, filed in the Caribbean bin, that I thought, well, this should be not in Caribbean because they're in Louisiana. And there were two important records to me. One was the Ardoin family, Boisec, Ardoin, Alphonse Boisec, Drywood Ardoin, accordionist, and Canary Fontenot, the fiddler. And the other was Clifton Chenier, the big beat rhythm and blues Zydeco man. And I said, this music can't be in North America. This sounds Caribbean. That's why someone filed it here. And so that set me on a course of how much more diverse is America than I've been taught. And I began to realize it's much more diverse, not just the cultural areas, but urban ethnicities and, you know, migrations and all these things are flowing through my mind.
And when you graduated from college, you got a job in radio. How did that happen?
So there's not much you can do with a BA in anthropology right off the bat, but I could do radio. So I ended up at WMMR Philadelphia. It was a Metro Media FM that was doing stereo, roots, rock, pop, very eclectic. And I was the afternoon guy, and I did it for 2 years until I began to realize this, you know, this just wasn't for me for eternity. But I did get to interview, you know, members of the Grateful Dead and the Kinks and Bette Midler and just lots of different people, because when the artists would wake up after their gigs, you know, they didn't want to do anything live on the radio till 1 or 2 in the afternoon. So I'd always get the interviews, and I got used to interviewing people live. I was under some pressure to play all these British hair bands, and I'd say, why am I going to play Foghat when I could play Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters? You know, why don't I play, you know, some modernist jazz and make that work with Randy Newman and then go to Ray Charles? And we were told we were given complete freedom, but I was increasingly under pressure to play the latest pop acts. And I also just didn't want to stay and keep doing, even though it was hip and a million hipsters would have loved my job, I just wanted to go deeper and wider.
Deeper and wider. So how did you go about that? What did you do?
So I went on what I call my Jack Kerouac meets Woody Guthrie trip, and went down through Virginia, and I went to the Carter family fold, and I went to see Doc Watson at his house, and I started doing interviews with people as I went, and finally got down to the Gulf Coast and came along through Florida and Alabama, New Orleans for a day. And I landed in Lafayette, where I knew somebody. And that really set me on coming back to French Louisiana after that. But then on, I went to Austin, decided I would go to graduate school at UT Austin in anthropology and folklore. And I came back to Connecticut, basically packed up and moved to Austin. And in Austin, I did radio. I worked on what people called a hippie country. And I was the only non-Texan. And they did make some fun of me, but I knew a lot of music they didn't know. Old Carter family and classic old country, certain types of blues. But they knew all the classic Texas stuff. And I had to learn, you know, how much I liked Ray Price and Waylon and Willie. And the Armadillo was going strong, the club there that became famous. And since I was on Saturday nights because all the locals wanted to go out and party, and I've been working in grad school all week, to me, nothing was more fun than being up there with a friend or two and playing the music. And, you know, come midnight, the Armadillo close, who comes in the door? Willie, Waylon, Commander Cody. So I got to
Willie Nelson.
Those guys. Yeah, Willie Nelson. So I integrated myself into that world. And then, but then the kind of new world of public folklore, my great hero was Archie Green, a labor folklorist. And he and I started producing features for NPR, did one on Folk Festival USA on Cajun and Zydeco, did a 90-minute documentary, and I told all the people I was starting to meet, both Afro-French and Cajun, this is going to be on. And they got a huge response. And I began to think, well, I can just use radio to reach all these people and support them in a public place. And they don't have to go to the same bingo parlor or the same dance hall. They can just all hear themselves, you know, they'll be together on the medium.
Because you went to Louisiana for field work with Afro-French Creole music. That was really pivotal. And I'd love to have you talk about that, because that really opened up the music of Louisiana that's been central to your career.
Well, it also opened up the idea that cultures aren't static, that cultures change, and that there are cultures we don't even understand fully because, you know, the Afro-French people were neither fully French. They were not white Cajuns. They were not white colonial descendants. But they were somewhat separated from Black folks, too. They were not Black Americans. They were Afro-French people, and they used the term Creole. And their music was a mix of French sources from West Africa and the Caribbean, rhythmically, sonically, in various ways, and American blues. So I began to see that the lines between people and culture were not as static as I'd been brought up to believe. And one of my key teachers was Americo Paredes, who I'd never known before I was in grad school, but he was a border scholar and also a singer. And he worked on the Texas-Mexican border and dealt with the culture that was neither fully Texas nor fully Mexican, but a very place where a lot of different culture music flourished and was very creative.
So this led you to go back to Louisiana, to Lafayette. And how did you connect with Alphonse Bossec Ardoin?
Yes. By then, I was starting to go all the time to little Corrida de Mardi Gras runs and all these little dance halls. And I had met a Bossec Ardoin at Mariposa, went to this festival up in Canada near Toronto. And Alphonse Ardoin was there with his son. I talked to him after he set, and I didn't speak any French. I had only studied Spanish. But he said to me something I never forgot. He said, "Quand tu visites la Louisiane, visite nous autres à la maison." When you come to Louisiana, come see us at the house. And so when I got to Lafayette, I told that to a couple friends. And then they sent me, said, "Well, go see Dewey Balfour, the Cajun fiddler, who like Boisec, would become a National Heritage Fellow in the early 80s. And Dewey let me live at his house. And so I lived out back in his outdoor kitchen, and for a breakfast and dinner and a place to sleep, I fed his cattle. I made sure the electrical fence was working. I harvested corn. I delivered insurance checks. He had a little insurance business. I helped him move furniture. He had a furniture store. And one night I came home and I said, "Dewey, I saw a sign that said the Ardoin family, Cat Coin, Ce Soir, Four Corners Club tonight." And he said, "Oh, Nick, you got to go there. See them. They're the best." So I go there, and there's Boisec, the man who told me, "Come see us at the house." And I said, and by now I'd been learning pretty good. I had Louisiana French going. So I walked up to him, and I said, "Monsieur Ardoin, est-ce que tu rappelles moi, moi, je suis Nick Spitzer, on a rencontré longtemps passé." And he says to me, he says, "Oh, yeah, moi, je t'ai dit visite à la maison quand je visite la Louisiana." I said, "Exactement, that's right, come to my house." And so he said, "Tomorrow at my son's club, we'll have an afternoon fado-do. You should come to that." So I went. It was about 15 miles from where I was staying. And I went there mid-afternoon. And I went to this little club. I never looked back. I eventually moved there and rented houses there. And eventually I would live in the Ardoin house for 3 months. It was sort of like the deal with Dewey, except I was gardening and I was going to the store. And, you know, I would always be there for family dinner. And, you know, I shared a room with the youngest son, who was a couple years younger than me. And, you know, I lived the life under a very strong matriarch of the family. Madame Ardoin took no guff from her husband or any of her guests.
Yeah. Let me just interrupt for a second. But in the meantime, you were able to record them and interview them and hear their music.
Oh, yeah. No, I interviewed them. And actually, I got a grant from the NEA. I made sound recordings of the Ardoin family and many others. I recorded old Creole songs, old French songs. And I did two albums, one called Zodico Louisiana Creole Music, that was a wide range of urban, rural, more French, more Afro. I'm in the process of getting all this stuff out on, and never brought it out as CDs. And then I did another one with the Lautel Playboys. So, you know, I did those and I started doing more radio. And once my grant ran out, I was substitute teaching in schools, which was another great way to learn what's going on culturally somewhere. On and off for a year and a half, I was there. Basically, I just lived it and, loved it.
And you ended up doing work for the Smithsonian for the 1976 Bicentennial. How did that unfold and what did you do for them?
Well, I went to Washington as a presenter of Louisiana French and Creole, but also old-time country and blues and all the things that I knew something about. And that's where I met Bess Lomax Hawes. Bess was the deputy director of the Office of Folklife Programs, and she was very good friends with Joe Wilson, who ran this nonprofit National Council for Traditional Arts. And Joe introduced me to Bess, and Bess knew what I was doing. And Bess was extremely excited that I had learned Louisiana French and, you know, had background in folklore training and wanted to do public work and was at the festival and was, you know, learning how to be on a stage and introduce people and do interviews and translate for publics and stuff. So after that happened, she said, "You know, we really want a state folklore program in Louisiana. If we post a listing, I hope that you will apply for that." And I said, "Why wouldn't I?" You know. And so I finished most of all my coursework, and then and the listing came up, and I applied. And she was close to Al Head, the director. He met me, and we got along very well, and. So he hired me to be the state folklorist. So now I've moved from, you know, making recordings and public radio and doing the scholarly stuff towards a dissertation to suddenly being a Louisiana state official, if we could call me that. And I had pretty much free rein to lobby, and I got pretty effective at it to where they started giving us money to do grants and projects. And in that time, we did a state recording series, blues, old-time country, Cajun, Zydeco. And we did a state guidebook, Louisiana Folklife, a guide to the state, kind of like the WPA guides of the 30s, but focused on, you know, living traditional arts and culture. And then the biggie, the World's Fair, Louisiana World Exposition. Russell Long and Carolyn Long got us $1 million from the timber industry to run a pavilion in an old warehouse, a tobacco warehouse, down in New Orleans. And so we put a crew together, and for 6 months, by hook and crook, we ran a stage, a little nightclub called The Back Door. By then, I'd gotten an exhibit together called The Creole State, and we had every Louisiana traditional artist we could find, craftspeople, boat makers, weavers, spinners, older ladies that sing cantiques, Cajun, Zydeco, Native American, and within a month, we got a tremendous review in Newsweek, a full-page review in Newsweek as the best thing at the World's Fair.
Congratulations. So tell me, first of all, how long were you in the position of folklorist in Louisiana?
7 years.
Okay. So you moved to Washington, to the Smithsonian, curating programs for the American Folklife Festival. What goes into that work?
Well, the first one I did at the Smithsonian was before I was hired to be there. I did the Louisiana State Program. And what goes into that is doing a lot of field work. But because I've been doing the World's Fair programming and helping a great team of folks there and working all around the state, I already had easily to find 120 people that we knew could go to Washington, whether they were old-time lace makers, fiddlers, French folk, African-American, Vietnamese, all the different people in the state, lots of Native Americans. We knew who would be willing and able to be out there for 2 weeks on the National Mall. And so I had had some experience before that where I'd come in and help. So I understood what the festival was more or less about. And so that year, the two featured areas were country of India and Louisiana, and they seemed to go pretty well together. They're both very, you know, strong differences of color and religion and magical rituals and festivals and music. And it was a festival to remember. And it was through that really time that it was cinched that I would come up there. And so in the October of 78, I moved to Washington. I enjoyed my time at the Smithsonian, and I did 5 years as a federal. And then I decided not to stay and continue, but I said I'll be an adjunct, and so I became a research associate, and then's when I really became independent.
And what were some of the things you were doing as an independent presenter?
Well, started doing, you know, tours to the Seychelles Islands with Louisiana Creole Zydeco people out in the Afro-French Islands in the Indian Ocean, and the most important thing for me was I did the centennial of Carnegie Hall with a series called Folk Masters. That got me going with how do you do traditional arts on proscenium stage with all the attendant stylistics of Carnegie Hall. And that in turn led me to actually, after that first year, just to come to Wolf Trap and do it there the next six seasons. And then in the middle of all this, from 1990 to 1997, we did the American Roots ROTS Independence Day concert, and I got it out live on NPR around the country, all stations that wanted to carry it, and we could see 250,000 people from there, their bodies in front of us, and I brought up Rebirth Brass and all these great New Orleans people that I knew, and we had great Cajun music and Zydeco and traditional fiddling. And over the years, we had Carl Perkins and we had the Staple Singers and, you know, we had all manner of gospel. And the evening events from 6 to 9, when the fireworks would start, those were when we really laid it out. And I co-hosted it with Fiona Ritchie and Georges Collinet and a lot of different people. But so suddenly this idea of concertizing on a big stage was outside like a festival. And then it was out on public radio. And, you know, the Park Service just helped us at every turn. And after doing that for all those years, I went to Santa Fe for 2 years to a think tank. And then I said, I'm going back to Louisiana. I miss that.
Yeah, what led you back to Louisiana, Nick?
Well, I said to myself, where is home in my life today? And, you know, I can't go back to Old Lyme, Connecticut. I love Philadelphia, but, you know, I'm not a college kid anymore. And I'd, you know, moved to Louisiana twice. You know, I'd gone in to do my field work there. Then I worked for the state. And I said to myself, I will move to New Orleans, where I always had loved it. And New Orleans is a Creole city filled with people called Creoles, with the mixing and the mingling of, you know, Sicilian, French, African-American, Afro-Creole. You know, it's a global city almost of the 19th century. And through the Park Service, I had become friends with people at the University of New Orleans. And they hired me as a folklorist there. And I taught cultures of the Gulf South. I taught oral history, Creoles and cultural Creolization.
Okay, you mentioned Creolization, and that concept is pretty central to your work. I want you to say what you mean by it and how it drives your work and the way you think about it.
Yeah, it's you could argue that on one level, there's people called Creoles with a capital C here and other places in the Caribbean and parts of South America. But moreover, you could look at things that are Creolized and mixed and mingled. So from my point of view, the world is in Creolization. We're in constant contact where continuities of old culture are mingled with new creativities and new things emerge. The easiest example is Ray Charles. Ray Charles grew up going with his mom to church, and he also went to the juke joint where he learned how to play blues piano with Wiley Pittman. He mingled the blues, the lonesome sound, the piano playing with the gospel shouts for joy, and he ends up with a new music. We call it soul. And so to me, soul didn't exist before. There was gospel over here and there was blues over there. So he made soul out of sacred and secular music around him. And that's why we call him a genius. He wouldn't call himself a Creole. He'd call himself a Black American. But the music is a mix that represents something new based on the merging of traditions. So I'm really into that in American society, a creative society where we have to look at the future as much as the past, and creativity from the past will lead us to more creative things in the future. So I see the world in Creolization, and I don't look for the barriers between groups of people. I look for what they've done together.
And when you moved to New Orleans, you created your radio show, American Roots. And I would like that origin story, please.
Well, I also said to myself, if I go back, I'm going to start a new radio show. And I can more efficiently reach more people if I do it a post-produced show, not a live event. And so I decided it would be called American Roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. And in 97 is when I moved back. And the university gave me financial support and allowed me to apply for grants. And I was very dutiful. I wrote the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and said, look, we'll do all the background research on this to show you why we think it'll work. Because I was very wonky. They wanted all that information. And they said, just send us a demo. I created a half-hour demo. We sent it in. And a week later, the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting called me and said, we're going to fund this. We want you to do this for at least a year. Just do what you're doing. Everyone thinks the demo's fantastic. It's what America needs to hear. And I said, that's what I think too. And so we started on the air in April of 1998 with 7 stations. Little by little, within about a month, we had 30 stations. By the end of the year, we had 60. A coffee company was underwriting us in Louisiana. And life just went on, producing the show out of an old bottling plant, water bottling plant in the French Quarter. And it's, you know, it just continued for 25 years to the current moment. And in that time, we now have 385 stations. We had continuous support from the NEA and the NEH and local businesses. And we made it to 25 years and just, you know, continued to grow. And we're one of the very few cultural performance programs left in public radio. You know, it's just been slow and steady. Keep going.
I know you've received offers from television over the course of your career, but you always stayed with radio. How come?
You know, I just felt radio is better for me because the microphone disappears. It's just your voice, somebody else's voice. We can record a live event. We don't need the lights everywhere. We can just have a conversation and people get comfortable and they go deep with their hopes, their joys, their sorrows. the why and what and how they make the music or do the craft they do, I just began to see the world more interconnected, more creolized, and more capable of having the kind of eclectic program that argues for what Americans share, you know, like country music and blues and jazz and gospel music, and then what distinguishes regions.
And say more about the format of American Roots for people who might not be so familiar with it.
These days, I refer to American Roots format as Gulf South by Southwest, with sojourns to the Caribbean and all points across the country. And I feel like in New Orleans, there's a lot of pride that we're inclusive of something as eclectic as what we do. Something that many program directors said, oh, you can't do something with it. It's mixed like that. Well, we've done it. and we keep doing it. And we're not the biggest show. We're not a news show. But we kind of commingle information in a newsy kind of way with culture and performance. And what we try to do is find concordances in words, in mood, in sonic things, contrasts and continuities that we can do segues, which is sort of the art form of radio flow of sound. And maybe every third sound, every third song will be very familiar to somebody, but it might be a familiar artist with a song they've never heard him sing, or a song that is quite familiar by a familiar artist, but not the one they might have expected to hear it sung by. And so you're always messing with things that work together. You can play old-time string band music and make it work with New Orleans traditional jazz. You can play blues and gospel and make it work with klezmer. You can play country and make it work with Hawaiian. You can do all kinds of things based on the sonics, the semantics, the moods, for the segues. And that's one thing we're proud of, that while we can narrate who the artists are and where they sang and a bit about the biography and the culture, we want people just to enjoy the show, whether they're listening in the foreground or the background. And so the eclecticism is not a barrier. It's an invitation.
You know, you've also, in the midst of everything, been teaching at Tulane now, for first the University of New Orleans and now Tulane for many, many years. And I wonder how teaching and radio come together for you. Somehow it just seems to me like being around students and younger people has to be good for what you bring to American Roots.
Well, we have probably 500,000 to 750,000 listeners each week, depending on the season and the show and whatever. You know, I go into a classroom, I have anywhere from, you know, 10 to 40 people. I've done a couple bigger classes, but in a funny way, for me personally, radio is a lot easier to do. It's all post-produced. And you can always do a pickup and a fix. I'm working with an engineer and co-producers and interviewing artists and, trimming the interviews and mixing music. And it's a team effort. And when it's made into its, 1 hour and 59 minute iteration for being sent out, I just feel great. And I hear it on the radio. But I've done radio for so long and it's so common to me to do that, I don't feel pressured by doing it. I mean, I love the interviews and everything. But when I'm in a classroom, I'm always trying to figure out how to reach students. It's very challenging, exhausting in some ways. At Tulane, more of the students are not from Louisiana, though that's beginning to change. Now it's gotten to where there's more and more younger people who are hip to deep roots, and especially blues and gospel and the sources of rap and hip hop and certain black genres that are, classic forms of Jubilee and this and that. And, and a lot more Cajuns and Creole descendants. And so, they're really excited to hear how the old music ends up as French rhythm and blues. And, they go along for the kind of creolization ride and discussion and enjoy it. But it is a lot to try to emote and intellectually work with audiences of students versus something where I've been knowing what I wanted to play and scripted and, ready to go with the team. And it's sort of an interesting balance between the worlds. It does take a lot of energy on both ends.
You were also the host for many years for the National Heritage Fellowship Concert.
That's right.
And I wonder first what your memories are of that experience, but then having been in D.C. as the recipient of the award.
It was weird. Yeah, I bet. Well, the first ones for Heritage were 1982. And who's getting the awards? My teachers in Louisiana, Boisec Ardouin, Ken Ray Fontenot, Dewey Balfa, all these people. I wasn't the host then. Pete Seeger was hosting early. And there were, you know, many, many other hosts over the years. And I you know, I see the people in the families where I lived as much my teachers of folk and traditional arts and how to make policy and how to produce programs as anybody in the academy that I learned from, more so. I mean, those people were like my new family, a lot of them, especially in the Creole communities. But it was a huge moment for me. When the last host retired, they asked me to do it in 97. And from 97 to 2014, I did it. And, you know, it was a lot of fun to go on stage and improv with people and help them get comfortable for that moment. And some of them were very shy and quiet or had a translator from the family. But we always found ways to enjoy one another's company. And, you know, I just try to give them two or three days of fun, humor, what we could talk about. And so I just loved these shows. They were just group improvisation with, you know, a Ukrainian egg decorator, you know, a shy older lady that did quilts in North Mississippi, people that you've never heard of, but also some of the greats of the culture, you know, cultures that we knew, like, you know, B.B. King and people that I'd always loved, all kinds of different blues people, Zydeco Man, Buzu Chavis, his family, all manner of people, some of whom I'd already known well, but most of whom I'd never met before.
But I also have to ask, the fact that you're given the Bess Lomax Halls Award has to be particularly gratifying because I know she was such an influence on your work.
Oh, definitely. There's a picture of myself and Bess that somebody took at the 1985 Smithsonian Festival. We were in the Louisiana area and we're both kind of smiling and talking. And I remember how much she influenced me and made me feel that I could be a state official, that I could manage not just working in Louisiana, but that maybe one time I'd come to Washington eventually, that really everything I could do to better understand and present culture could flow from the work. And I saw her as kind of a matriarchal, grandmotherly blessing figure in my life. And so that it was named after her, yes, it was very meaningful to me for it to happen that way.
And I could not be happier, Nick. That is the truth. So many, many congratulations on a well-deserved award.
You.
And I think that is a great place to leave it. Nick, thank you for giving me your time.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking me the questions.
That was Folklife presenter, educator, the producer and host of American Roots, and the 2023 Bess Lomax Halls National Heritage Fellow, Nick Spitzer. To find out more about American Roots, check out its website, AmericanRoots.wwno.org. And you can also check out all of the 23 National Heritage Fellows on our website at arts.gov. And we'll have links to both in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.